One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Insane in the Membrane.
Insane in the Membrane.
Greetings, one and all. It's still the lockdown. It's still happening. We don't know what's happening, but loads is happening. America is on fire and it's all kicking off. But don't let that get to you. Don't worry. We'll come through the other side. We'll all be fine. Don't you worry about that. Before we begin, I just want to say thank you again to all you lovely people for putting in your five-star reviews. JW487, thank you so much for being so wonderful. We really appreciate that, putting in the reviews and it all helps. If anyone when you're listening to this, please do that. Go to Spotify or Acast or wherever you listen to your podcast. And if you're able to do that, leave us a review. But 5 stars, don't do any less than that. It's a waste of time because this is a 5-star show. Do that for us, and then it just pushes us up the charts. It pushes us into the ears of other people, and it just gets more people listening to it. So we can do more things. So that'd be lovely if you do that. That'd be great. Thank you so much. So yeah, thank you for that. We've got Islington Radio. We've got our radio show that we do, which is on Mixcloud. Now, all you need is the app. Just get the app, the Mixcloud app. It doesn't cost you anything. Get the Mixcloud app, and then you go on there, put in Tuned Up Time Machine, and then that will take you to the greatest radio show that you've ever heard. It's really good. Honestly, even I've listened to it. You'll really enjoy it. The music's great. The chat's brilliant. If you've got any requests, drop me a line. I'm on Instagram and things like that. On Instagram is Tuned Up Time Machine, or I Am Rich Wilson, or on Twitter, I Am Rich Wilson. You can find me. Drop me a line. Even if you want to just say hello and have a chat, drop me a line. Especially now, when we're all locked away and we're all worried about what's going on and we're locked away from each other, drop me a line. I have a chat with quite a few people, actually. I get messages all the time. So do that. Have a chat. And if you want to, if it's there, or some music that I've not heard and would like, I think I would dig, tell me about it. Let's hear about it. Let's get into this. Speaking of which, also, what we're doing with the podcast, we're doing a thing called Patreon Picks. And that's where we'll get our lovely patrons to tell us about a favourite episode of theirs or a favourite guest. And what we're going to start doing, we've done this already, we're going to start having a chat with the wonderful patrons. So if you let us know, what we'll do, we'll get producer Paul to hook us up, and then we'll have a little bit of a chat, like a proper chat, and then we'll put that out as a little snippet, and so people will listen to that and they go, oh, that's intriguing, and then they'll come and listen to the podcast. So we're going to do that. So that's to our patrons. Drop me a line and then you and I will have a proper, not an interview, but a conversation. You can tell me about yourself and what you enjoy about the podcast and why and blah blah blah, and then we'll do that and then we'll put that out. So many things. So if you want to become a patron, which is always lovely, do that. It's like you can just a couple of quid every month, and that just helps us keep the lights on. We don't make any money from doing this. Everything we get goes back into the podcast. So if you want to do that and support the podcast, that would be wonderful as well. You are wonderful. Do you know what though? If you're actually just listening to this, that's enough. I love that. Thank you so much for listening. It means it's worth doing if people are listening to it. Let's get on with the episode. This week's guest, comedy royalty, podcasting royalty, definitely. I've been a big fan of this man for many years, since the 90s when he's with it was with Lee and Herring, and I've wanted to get him on for ages because I did his podcast, and which again was kind of like, whoa, I can't believe I'm doing this. Richard Herring is this week's guest, and what questions do you ask the man that has been asked and has asked probably every question that there ever has been or is going to be? But I didn't have to worry about that. He's so easy to talk to. He came on and he just chatted away, and it was wonderful. It's a real joy to have him on, and it's another moment for me going, oh, I can't believe Richard Herring came on. You know, it's a nice moment, and he was really cool, and you'll hear that now. Also, I've got to let you know, you'll hear in the background, there's doorbells and dogs and things like that, maybe a cough here or there, or some noise from around and about the place, because as you know, because of the lockdowns now, we're having to do this via clean feed and Zoom and via the internet, so you're going to get some noises of life going on around us, but don't worry about that, that shouldn't take away from your enjoyment. So, coming up in just a bit is Richard Herring.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
A podcast from producer paul.co.uk.
And it's funny, I was excited about having you on, but then I was a bit nervous as well, because I'm like, how do you interview the man that interviews everybody? Like, you know, we were saying last night, Jade and I were like, why don't you think of a question that he's never been asked? I'm like, are you kidding?
I've thought of a lot of questions now. I think they'd be hard to find one that I've never... Occasionally things come up that I think, oh, that's quite a good idea. But, you know, But that, as a comedian, that's just... I think that's the only reason my podcast works is because I'm so... Well, not the only reason, but one of the reasons it works is because I'm so used to being interviewed by journalists who don't really know who I am that... A, yeah. If you bother to find a bit out about a person, then they're impressed anyway. But B, if you ask them something they're unlikely to have been asked before, you get a much more interesting conversation. So it's just, you know, when you know, you've got with podcasts, you've got that freedom to go on for 90 minutes if you want, we used to do 2 hours sometimes with
wow.
the other ones.
Wow.
And, you know, you get into some interesting areas then, and you kind of go off the beaten path and people tell you stuff they haven't told anyone else. You know, so I think it's even like the comedians, you know, like I had Bill Burr on, who obviously has no idea who I am.
Wow.
And he seemed a bit like prickly at the start and, you know, thinking, here's another thing. But I think just by being interviewed by another comedian, you know, he immediately kind of warmed up and warmed to the conversation, I think, and gave he's sort of renowned for being quite dismissive and prickly. And I think he had a good time. So,
yeah,
you know, it's interesting. So, you know, I think when you've been. I've been doing comedy for a long time and obviously doing interviewing for a long time. So within that, so it's, yeah, hopefully I'm getting better at it.
Yeah, you know, so yeah. But I really enjoy doing this. Because I MC a lot at gigs.
Yeah.
So you're basically interviewing the audience.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and that's why I really enjoy doing this.
Yeah, it's a real skill to do that, to do the emceeing as well. And, to pick up, I was Nina Conti was on my podcast last night, and she's so good at what she's doing with her improvisational skills and her ventriloquist skills are just astonishing. But she's really great. What she does is sort of magic with audience participation. But she's obviously doing that. She's not intuing anyone. She's doing both sides of the conversation. But it's absolutely beautiful to see. I've never seen anything quite like it, really. When she gets the audience up and sort of decides what their personality is and then goes into that. And she's basically interviewing herself, but doing it by judging the person who's up and their body language and stuff. And then the way the person reacts to that. So that's sort of interesting, because that's interviewing someone without letting them talk. But but she does get a lot out of the people. I wrote in my book, just, this is fucking magic. It's like magic what she does. It's great. But yeah, so it's, I really, I'm not so good. I've tried to do ventriloquism on stage a couple of times and I'm too nervous to kind of really push it, which I'm fine on doing here at home. She just said, like, go with it. And it's letting go. And I think that's the same with that emceeing and talking to the audience. It's just jumping in and not being scared, isn't it? And not worrying about failure. But that's a real skill, I think. The people who do that well, the people who do it badly can kill a gig, and the people who do it well can just make a gig fly.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's funny we're doing this, because mental health is the jumping off point, but it sort of goes, look, as soon as you say to anybody, it's a mental health podcast, people immediately get a little bit nervous, and they're like, I might give too much away. And you're like, look, just relax. That's just the jumping off point. It goes wherever. Sure. It's, you know, so you talk about it wherever you want. But I find getting people to be guests on it is sometimes tricky.
Sure, you know, I can see that. But, you know, I sort of think comedy and mental health sort of go hand in hand, you know what I mean? And I think a lot of what I do in my comedy is sort of flirting around with mental illness and where the line between sanity and insanity rests. You know, and it's very, and there is no line really, and it's a fluid thing, and what is sanity and what is insanity? but you know, I think that in the lots of the things I'm doing online, like the ventriloquist stuff, and like the playing snooker against myself, and I've just been out doing a stone clear where I've done a really properly crazy one. Yeah. Where just because coming off the, you know, what's happening in America as we're recording this, you know, that's properly crazy. So I sort of like the idea of a man walking around a field trying to put stones in order sort of seems sane in response, but also that it has this messianic element to it, where obviously the character of Richard Herring, who's doing that, who's very similar to me, feels that he's on some kind of holy mission, which, you know, arguably a lot of politicians do as well. So, that's what comedy is, isn't it? It's someone going, and partly it's someone going up on stage and disobeying the rules of the polite rules of society and picking away at the bits of our mind that we worry across. You know, I think that's a worry, isn't it, to everyone, that are you crazy? Are the things that you do in private normal? Are they not normal? And I think we don't talk about it. And I think what you and a few other people are doing with podcasts like this and some comedy shows as well is great, because it just allows people to go, oh, okay, so yeah, you know, this isn't, I'm not, you know, it's not unusual to have these thoughts. It's not unusual to be depressed. It's not unusual to not be able to hold it together all the time. You know, I think society lives on this artifice, and part of comedians' jobs is to prick away at the artifice, make us laugh about it, but almost reinforce it as well. Because, you know, have everyone leaving going, yes, I'm going to throw away my whole life. This whole life is a sham. Society and civilization is insane. But, you know, the human animal is just so unusual, you know, and so unique, I think. Yeah. And possibly, I was talking about this with Nina, I'm sort of joking, but people say there must be life elsewhere in the universe, and I'm sure there's life of some kinds, but I just wonder whether, you know, what's all the elements of chance that have led to us being here and surviving long enough, and all the ways we've adapted to the world. I just wonder how often that sort of thing crops up, that something of the right size with the right dexterity and the right brain size. Because, you know, there's been hundreds of millions of years on Earth without anything like us being around. And then we just, an asteroid hitting and whatever, and all the bits of luck and fortune that allowed the human species to evolve. I wonder how often it happens, really, that you get sort of intelligent life, and you know, it's not, we're not really meant to, you know, well, there's no meant in it, because I don't think there's any plan, but are we, you know, most animals don't consider their lives and deaths and
no.
philosophy and, you know, and just get on with stuff. And we're sort of trapped in this craziness where we're forced to acknowledge our own mortality and try to understand how the world works. And being curious about how the world works and coming up with theories of how the world works, some of which turn out to be true and some of which turn out to be, you know, in a lot of what keeps society running is insanity, isn't it? Religion is, it keeps society running, but it's certainly, even if you believe in it, you would acknowledge that certain elements of religion go a bit far.
Well, isn't it Finland or somewhere like that where they've now said that they now categorised religious faith as a mental illness?
I don't know that, but I mean, it's sort of, but it's obviously a human thing. And like what's happening in America again, even though a lot of the people who support Trump probably are religious, that's become a little cult, hasn't it? It's become a cult of this guy is insisting that he can never be wrong and we believe him, and so he must have been cheated out of this election. And despite the fact there's obviously no real evidence and that the evidence that's being presented is clearly fabricated, because if you were so sophisticated to be able to cheat an election, you wouldn't have people, you know, film of people throwing votes in the river or whatever. So you know, it's people believe in something so much, and people need, you know, there's obviously a human need to have faith in something. And I, when I did the show Christ on a Bike, which was about my own relationship with Jesus and being brought up as a Christian, you know, we all believe in crazy made up shit to get through life, you know, and everything's everything in civilization is artifice. And we all have rules we live our life by, but they're not universal truths, you know. They're just things we've decided are a good way to run society, and some of them are a good way to run society, and some of them were a good way to run society and aren't anymore. And so, you know, it's when you really, and I think as comedians we stop and think about stuff a lot and have time to think about stuff, and it's sort of our job to think about stuff. And when you do stop and think about it, it is, you know, it's difficult not to be overwhelmed
by the
insanity of life, but also hopefully, you know, by finding what's insane, hopefully you can laugh at it and not go insane. But that's what I find interesting about, you know, with all these things where I've flirted around with let's do something where I allow that crazy side of myself to come out in my comedy, or, you know, push things a bit further. There's been times when, you know, I've had to stop for a bit because I've felt like actually, you know, I have got a quite obsessive personality, which is where a lot of these things come from. And there was a point when I was doing the stone clearing where I sort of felt I had to do it every day, even if I wasn't recording it and even if I was just walking the dog, which is sort of how it started. So it started not as a podcast. And then I sort of thought, well, no, you know, I need to, you know, I don't. I need to go and have a bit of time away from doing this because, you know, I'm sort of aping the obsessions you get. So there's little things I have to do on every trip round the field.
Oh, really?
And certain cairns that need to. So there's an alpha and omega cairn which starts. I have to put one on at the beginning and one at the end. I might have forgotten to do it today. Shit. And there's the ditch that stopped Brexit, which I believed if I kept throwing a stone in every time I passed it that Brexit wouldn't happen. And you know, I'm still believing in it. I still have faith in it.
Is it funny that, like you said, like we're animals, but we also need some form of order.
Yeah, and human beings have observed the world that this is what's happened throughout here. Once you sort of start to understand how religions work, and I've done a few things in my life that are crazy stunts where you get upset. You know, I tried to spot all the number plates in numerical order from 1 to 999 when that was the system, or just after that was the system. And you start to believe that if you do certain things, the car you need will appear. And that's it. You start to have these little. And that's how religion started up, and that's how science started up. Someone would do something, and there would seemingly be a reaction, and then you would believe that the two things were connected, the causality, isn't it? And sometimes they are, and sometimes they aren't. So, you know, sacrificing someone on top of a hilltop to make the sunrise seem to work, or whatever, you know, or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
And so then you think, oh, I better keep doing it, because if I stop doing, what if the sun doesn't rise? So, you know, it takes. It's, you know, it takes a long time to work out what's true and what's not, and I think those ideas of supernatural ability and, you know, and the fact that something could be lucky and something could be unlucky are very hard to shift, and those are still And maybe it's part of being human. You know, people gamble thinking that they have, that there's a lucky number or there's a lucky system, and, you know, they're gambling and stuff that's just chance, and they believe that they have a system. So there's all these, we all have beliefs, and we all believe, you know, democracy, which people would be prepared to fight and die for, isn't a real thing. It's an artificial construct, and yet people would be prepared to die for it, and yet then it could disappear and something else would come along. And, you know, so it's, there's no right and wrong in a universal sense. But that's not to say you shouldn't have a code by which you live your life. But it's not. But it's also not to say, you know, because in another time, another place, what you believe is that is 100% true. Some they would not believe at all. So it's, you know, it's sort of fascinating and interesting the way the human brain works. And even someone who's, you know, I see myself as logical and sort of against superstition. But I, you know, I do completely get sucked into all these things and mildly believe I have a ghost in my house, even though I'm absolutely certain there are no such thing as ghosts.
I mean, I'm exactly the same. I'm exactly the same with superstition. Every time I give somebody money in the, like, someone says, oh, I've got any change. And I've said this to Jade, every time I give someone money, something shit happens to me. And I don't, and I'm like, and I'm, so it got to the point, I'm like, I don't want to give people money anymore. And I want to help. And so one time I'd given someone some money, and then an hour later, my phone got stolen from right in front of my eyes. It was right in front of me. And another time I'd given money and someone knocked my phone out of my hand. It went under the train at Upminster Station. The last time I was in Pret. Tottenham Court Road, and I came out, and as I was coming out, the guy behind the counter said, oh, do you want this? And he gave me a hot baguette. He went, look, we're just going to throw it away, just have this. I went, oh, thanks very much. And I came out, and there was a guy sitting outside, and I went, mate, do you want this? You know, there was a guy sitting there, and he went, yeah. And I walked away, and in my head, I went, universe, do your worst. And and then that was it. That was in March. That was in March. And then the man had the bat in a market. And I'm not saying the two things are connected.
But that's where it gets you. Yeah. So you start thinking, there'll always be something bad that happens, especially if you're going to go worldwide, right? So, I did that, and then, Bobby Ball died. This is my fault. So it's, if you're looking for things, you'll see, you know, you spot patterns, and that's why we do need experts and we do need science, because they operate beyond that. So the idea of common sense is sort of nonsense. You know, there are things where there's understanding life and getting through that, but things that seem like common sense, like leaving the EU, it seemed like common sense to people, like it doesn't always play out, you know, because you're using your own prejudice. I kind of like that idea that the Severn Bridge, you know, you'd pay a toll to go across to Wales on the Severn Bridge if you're coming from England. But they've abolished it because actually common sense says, oh, that's a great way of making revenue, but it actually has a negative impact on the economy as a result of that happening, because obviously some people don't come through when they would, don't spend money. So it's very hard, unless you understand how economics actually functions, to go, oh, this makes sense. If this is happening, then this means this. You know, so that's the way the human brain works. We're not meant to be looking on a universal, you know, we're not meant to be looking down on the planet and working out how things go, or looking out into space and understanding what a signal from a telescope means. But we can do it, you know. We're so astonishing as a species, like so astonishing what we've achieved and what we know, and we don't know, and you know, even 1% of what's going on, do we? But we know so much more than any other creature on this planet would ever know.
Yeah, absolutely.
And yet we're still, you know, we're still kind of chained to this primitive human brain that had to survive, you know, in what must have been absolutely terrifying circumstances of, you know, being living on the African savannah, even, you know, and having being attacked by wild creatures. Of course you're going to go, there's a devil. You know, when you're around the campfire, and go, stay around the campfire because the devil's out there. And if you went out there, you'd be consumed by some kind of horrific beast that you wouldn't be able, you know, you'd be in total darkness. Literally and figuratively. So it's not surprising, like, religions came up and there was goodies and baddies in the religion, and it's not surprising people thought, oh, if we pray to God, then our crop survives. As long as that works, it works, and if it doesn't work, you die out anyway, so your religion doesn't survive. So it's a sort of self-fulfilling thing, really, religion. But this,
yeah,
but yeah, but it's crazy. It is a form of mental illness. But I'd also say that so is nearly everything we yes. think. So, you know, I think it's not. And I think religion does do an awful lot of good as well. And that's
oh for sure.
That's,
yeah.
That's what, and most religious people are fairly decent and nice.
Yes. Yeah,
and some of them aren't. So you know, there we go.
But it's that there is a comfort in that. When it didn't make sense anymore, that to me anyway, that there was some kind of being looking out for us.
Yeah,
there was a sadness. That's a shame. It's like when you're a kid and you realise that magic isn't real, you know.
Yeah, well, you want things to be ordered and you want things to, you know, because it's more frightening. The reason conspiracy theories are working so, are spreading so, and bedding in is because the idea that stuff happens by accident and that awful things can happen is too scary. So you want the idea of there being a god or a controlling force, or even if it's a cabal of paedophiles who are running the world in order to have sex with people in the basement of a pizza shop. You know, it's reassuring to those people to think that explains why the world works like it does, rather than going, oh, shit, yeah, actually, you know, we got... The people in charge just had no fucking idea what's going on either. So it's people, you know, there's a human thing where, you know, and this is why bad things can happen. You want to be controlled and you want to believe. And if the right person comes along and even the wrong person comes along, then, you know, you can get behind them. And it's fascinating and terrifying. And I don't think there's much we can do to really change it. I think it sort of feels like, all these, you know, hundreds of years of, or sort of 500 years of enlightenment and moving forward and forward, and yet we're still basically living in the kind of, you know, witch-burning era in some people's minds. I don't know whether that will ever really change, because I don't know, I don't think we can rewire our brains to get away from it enough, or enough of our brains. And, you know, and like, even if you and I are still making those links between things that aren't linked, then if we've thought about it and they're still doing it, then what hope for us?
Well, I think that's it. I mean, we've still got that mob mentality. I mean, when you come to something like Twitter, and now there's that need to pile on and instead of a sort of rational conversation, it's all like, they've said this, then we must destroy them. So we've still got it in that.
But, you know, I suppose it goes back to... you know, we need to be in gangs and we need to be in groups that protect each other. And so, you know, if someone is being heretical from the group think, then they need to be expelled, because they could actually destroy the fabric of the tribe. You know, so if someone's coming, you know, there isn't a god and this what you're doing makes no difference, that creates enough of a crack to drive apart the tribe. And so I think there's just something in us that want, you know, it's horrific, I think. And people who think they're good people doing the piling on, and I'm sure, you know, we're all guilty of it to some extent.
Yeah.
Not being able to understand or forgive or even look into the facts of stuff before. You know, and I've certainly been the target of it on occasion, and it's very unsettling, and it's amazing how quickly the thing you said gets left behind, and then there's this whole new bolted on load of extra stuff that gets added to it that you never said or never thought. You know, people assume if you say one thing, you must think this. And then that means you did do that. And then suddenly, you know, and so you, there's things I tweeted, you know, nice things I tweeted that you wouldn't think would ever lead to people hating you for months and years and years, and just very benign things. And yet they still, every now and again, they still come back, and people, you know, and I've said plenty of terrible, awful things I'd perhaps deserve to be castigated for. But it's nearly always the nice things where we're going, Richard Herring thinks this. And you go, because I said we should call people whatever they want to be called. Yes! You hunt people. Well, I just thought that was a nice thing to say. You'd be amazed. So, yeah, it's nuts, and that mob mentality is... it's sort of unbelievable, and it's unbelievable when it comes from, there's a group, you know, there'll be a group of people I mean, what's everything's going on? So it's these basically two tribes to every argument now, and neither tribe realizes they're acting exactly like the other tribe.
Yeah, exactly.
And then they're pushing each other to extremes, I suppose. I don't know. I mean, it's not 100% true. I would say that, again, you know, the polar opposites in what's... Well, I would say that because I'm on this side, but the polar opposites in the presidential thing that's happening at the moment, I think, are not equally shared. But there you go. I guess that might be my own prejudice, I suppose. But then,
yeah. But look, going back to what you were saying about the fact that we exist is pure chance, really.
Yeah.
And that should be we should be walking around every day going, fucking hell. Well, fucking hell.
But life is, you know, whatever life you're leading pretty much on the planet of now as a human being is sort of so more amazing than any other creature would ever hope to have. And life is funny, and life, there's beauty in it. And I guess, I don't know, I think there are people who take life too seriously. It's sort of a, you know, we're the humanity is a sort of joke. It's a cosmic joke. We shouldn't be here. This isn't what, you know, nothing's meant to happen, but this is just this little offshoot of nuttiness that we become consciousness and the ability to think the way we think. And it should be just, we should be laughing the whole time at the situation we find ourselves in. And yeah, the luck of being, you know, I always go on about this in my sets, but the luck of even from, you know, your parents having sex at the right time and your sperm getting through.
Yeah.
The chances of that are so infinitesimally small already that it's the exact right moment, the exact right time, everything, and it all worked out and everything happened. But then that your parents met and they decided to have children together, or that managed to have children together, and that their parents met and their parents met, and each time multiplying. So the idea of, you know, any of us as individuals being here is sort of impossible.
Yeah,
I mean, it's as unlikely as to be just impossible. It makes me think maybe we're just characters in a computer game, but that's another. Which would be nice. Again, that takes the pressure off, doesn't it, if we're just being controlled.
Yeah,
it would explain a lot. It would explain why when you do something nice, something bad happens, Rich, wouldn't it?
Exactly.
It's a teenager making it happen. Going, oh, he's done something nice. Let's punish him.
He needs to learn about life, this one. He needs to learn. Maybe that's it. We're just a giant game of Sims.
Yeah.
And that's it.
I mean, it could be. It says apparently it's more likely than not.
But I think that where people's mental illnesses stem from is the, like we talked about, the human things that are put onto life. So,
yeah.
So that, you know, people stress about money, and money is this, you know... I know I suffer with that. I'm like, oh, God, I haven't got any money. Oh, shit, now what am I going to do? And it becomes, I get caught up in that stuff. Yeah. And you're like, God, if we just went back to bartering like we used to, if I could have a skill and just went, look, I'll do this for you if I can have a chicken. You know, it just seems a bit more simple.
But it does, but it would be so inconvenient. I mean, the thing with money is it's become extreme and terrible. And the idea of one person owning, you know, half the money in the world or whatever it is insane. But also the idea of going, rather than me having to find someone who can do that thing for you so that you could do that thing for me, and the chain of people you'd have to do, here's a little a piece of paper or a coin or an imaginary, you know, money's imaginary. If we just said, I'm not going to do it anymore, it wouldn't exist. It's just because everyone buys in. It's another sort of, we have faith in it, we believe in it, and we believe it's a thing, but money isn't a thing. If everyone just said, nah, we're not doing that anymore, it would suddenly, everything would disappear.
Well,
that's what's crazy. But it's, at the essence of it, it's a very good system. And if someone works a bit harder than someone else, isn't that fair? They get a little bit more money. But then it's sort of, oh, but if someone manages to help someone else make more money, shouldn't they get it? Oh, yeah, and if they can take that money into... So, you know, it sort of spirals out into nonsense again, because it's not... It's an artifice. It's not a real thing. And if you can find ways to exploit it. And I guess humanity, and probably all animal life, you're trying... However giving and nice you think you are, you're looking after yourself and you're trying to find your own, give yourself a little edge. You're giving yourself a little edge. That makes sense in an evolutionary sense, that if you give yourself a little edge, if you've got more resources, you've got a better chance of passing on your genes to the next generation. It's sort of simple as that. And we're all going to give ourselves, you know, and then that edge is always going to move up.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, if you've got money, I've certainly had times when I've had no money and I know exactly what you're talking about. I know the jealousy of looking at people who have got money. And, you know, I remember moving to London and driving around, you know, being on the bus, going up, sort of Chelsea and Fulham, and just so angry that people were spending thousands of pounds on a table, you know, and I couldn't afford to eat anything more than baked potatoes. You go, why? That's so unfair. But then obviously as your life progresses and you get a few more things, you're going, oh, well, no, there's always someone above you can look at and go, oh, that's unfair that they've got billions of pounds to my thousands of pounds. So it does create... Yeah, it creates so many problems, but yeah, I don't see there's another way around it. I don't think there's any way of. The irony is, money will probably destroy us. It'll probably be the thing that destroys us. Because the, you know, the impetus to make money in the short term. But this is a human thing again. It's the ability to think in the long term is something that most people aren't blessed with. And most people, if I said to you, I'll give you £100,000 now, but it means that in 40 years' time, people might not be able to live in certain areas of the planet. Most people go, well, no, I'll take the £100,000. Yeah. So, you know, these big, yeah. You know, they might not be. It might not happen. And so you believe what you want to believe as well. And that's why. So that's with COVID, with all this stuff. People are believing what they want to believe because they don't want to have to stay inside and they don't want to have to wear masks. So they start to believe that that's not necessary because it's inconvenient to their lives. It's understandable that they would do that, but it's also crazy because, you know, you just have to look at the. And unless you start just believing that all things that are fed to you are lies, and then that's another form of craziness. What I love about the sort of conspiracy theory mentality is it's people who are so worried about being proved to be gullible that they won't believe anything, which is the same as being gullible. So the gullible is believing everything, and not believing anything is the same because you don't have the facility to be able to work out what's real and what's not. And that's when you're not gullible, that's you could go, okay, I know that this guy's on the level and I think this guy might not be on the level. You can never be 100% sure, but you get an idea of who you can trust and who you can't trust. If you're just trusting nothing, then you're just the same as someone who's trusting everything because you're not able to make the decision in the middle of, oh, this, I, you know, there's enough evidence here to say that this is the case. And if you're going to live your life thinking everything is some sort of con and every, you know, and you're being, and there's these faceless lizard figures who are controlling our lives, then, you know, you're not going to get anywhere really because it's, you know, even if you're right, what's the use in it? I mean, if you're right, why the hell have these lizard people allowed this information to get out? And why aren't they stamping down on all the people who are revealing it? If they're that powerful, they'll just, oh, no, let them carry on. Let them carry on with it. It's not even having the ability to sort of understand, you know, to work out beyond, you know, the logic behind what they're saying, you know, and it's,
yeah.
I love the one about Paul, you know, that Paul McCartney's replaced in 1964.
Oh, amazing.
He has a car accident. People genuinely believe, if you look on the internet, people genuinely believe it. And the chances of finding someone who looks enough like Paul McCartney who can play the instruments and be in the band and then start composing songs that are better than Paul McCartney was doing in the early 60s. I mean,
they really struck gold.
And all that happens and no one else, Jane Asher doesn't go, oh, do I have to go out? This isn't the same bloke I was going out with. No, you have to
put your hat on.
None of the people who found the axe and went, oh, should we? One of the Beatles is dead. Yeah, just we'll keep it quiet. Here's £100. We'll keep that quiet for 60 or 50 years. It'll be fine. 60 years. So, you know, it's not having the logical ability to think, what would it mean to fake the moon landing? What would it mean for 9/11 to be a conspiracy? You know, how many people would have to be involved and how good are people at keeping things secret, and they're really not good. When you think about, I think there's someone worked out the moon landing would take like 250,000 people in on the conspiracy.
Wow.
That I can't remember what the figure is, but it's something insane. But, you know, the idea that 250,000 people in all those years, no one would go, actually, I could, I've got some proof for you. Give me $1 million. And, you know, no one's going to do that because, of course, they would. And it would be out the next day. Some bloke would be in the bar going, yeah, I faked the moon landing. I think it was me. I did it.
Yeah. Walking around with his tinfoil hat. It was me. It was at the cinema. Not last year, before the Apollo, the moon landing and the thing and I was looking. And you're looking at the craft that was landing on the moon. And you go, I can see why they think this is faked. Because that looks fucked.
Yeah, yeah. I know. I can understand why they would think it is, but you know, and it's not inconceivable. I mean, things that's the problem. Obviously, things, there are lies and there are conspiracies. Some of them we found out about, and some of them we don't know about.
Yeah.
Things definitely are. You know, there are that, and that's the problem. If nothing was ever faked or nothing was ever a lie, then it would be easy, wouldn't it? But but it's just working out the likelihood of. Of all this, you know, the flat, people believe in the Earth's flat.
Yes.
Now, you know, and that becoming a thing again is absolutely insane. You can just look at the horizon and see it's not flat.
Yeah, well, that goes back, like you said, it's the tribal thing, isn't it? They find other like-minded people and then they get a bit of attention and then they get a bit, they go, oh, now they're part of something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's interesting, but it's fact. But I've always been fascinated by it. A lot of my comedy is driven by it. A lot of our comedy, the stuff I was doing, Stuart Lee in the 90s, we were both kind of obsessed with people who were obsessed with stuff. So a lot of our stuff was people pretending to be things, or like that we had a hobby guy who was just so obsessive about hobbies that he sort of didn't see the damage they were causing outside, which is possibly what I've become in reality. There's people, a man pretending to be Rod Hull because he wants jelly and he's worked out that's a way of getting jelly. You think it's sort of, you know, people and keeping up subterfuge in order to carry on with stuff, but yeah, that obsession, we just loved those sort of fanzines you'd find. It was just before the internet, and I suppose the internet has really brought it into sharp focus that there's that the way people latch onto something, you know, and conspiracy theorists and that sort of thing. It used to be a laughable minority of people that you could go, oh, this is funny, and now it's sort of drifting into the mainstream in the same way I think what we're talking about before, that, you know, people, Mary Whitehouse and all the people trying to stop rude stuff on TV were a kind of minority group of what looked like loons, right, into the BBC and Green Ink. And now we're sort of, people are doing that job for them. I mean, if Mary Whitehouse was alive now, she would not believe this army of people who are there to jump in and complain about something that they haven't even seen, that they haven't, you know, before it's even come out, people offended by something. And you know, it's sort of, the internet has brought that part of humanity into sharp focus, and yeah, you know, and made it very, you know, I think we will get through it as a species, and I think we will adapt, but it's all that stuff's happened so fast, and of course all the kind of mental issues that it leads to, because I think, I suppose for me as growing up, the idea of, you know, popularity and cliques and who was friends with who, that was hard enough growing up without the internet and the confusion over how some people are popular and others aren't, and what makes someone likable and what makes, you know, you think you're being nice and yet someone else who's a bit of a dick is more popular because they're funny or whatever. And that was, you know, I still find that confusing. But then with the internet and it's all, you know, under sharp focus and people feel comfortable just telling you directly what they think, and even I think sometimes what they don't think, you know, people can be just outright rude to you. And, you know, we have to find ways to deal with that personally. I think also in ways of cope, of making it a coping thing. Because I'm terrified for my kids having to grow up in a world where their, you know, their optimism and their belief in themselves is going to be smashed.
Yeah, yeah.
But that, you know, that's what life does. It's not the internet. It's us and people and competition and jealousies and all that sort of thing that make it happen, but it's human emotions. But I suppose the internet makes it in a sharper focus. But yeah. I don't know. Again, as a comedian, I think on the whole, I'm sort of fairly impervious to all that stuff now.
Yeah.
Not entirely, but it's occasionally something surprises me and gets to me. I usually find, you know, I find it funny. I find being criticised by people on YouTube or Twitter quite amusing, and I like either responding or just What I love on YouTube is just that you can block someone straight away and delete their comment and it drives them nuts. And they go, you can't, how dare you? You know, that's the worst thing, to delete someone's comment. Delete. And then they go away because there's no, you know, so you, when you're in total autonomous control of something, it's brilliant because you absolutely decide what goes into it and what goes out of it. And that's why I love YouTube, because occasionally some men's right activists who've misunderstood what I'm doing on March the 8th or whatever will get in a little gang and attack you. And yeah, you know, and to be fair, sometimes it's feminists, and sometimes it's, you know, it's all. I get it from all directions, which is kind of interesting. But yeah, at the moment, it's mainly that. But you know, I remember one day was, I think it was like, I'm not quite sure which it was. I think it was, there was a lot of people commenting on Sophie Duker's Rahela Stupa, because she'd just done the Kill Whitey thing on Frankie Boyle show. But it was a lot of just basic racist stuff coming through. Yeah. And, you know, and I think I replied to one of them and said, oh, it's interesting. You know, people, there's a certain type of person who comments on women being on my show and black people being on my show,
right,
and never comment on anyone else in the same way. And so you could sort of go, oh, I wonder why you never say men are confident, you know, or
yes,
you know, I've had a lot of very confident men on this show. I don't know why you'd say that. And then I met one of them said, right, you're in trouble now, honestly. Oh, yeah. And then
see him rolling his sleeves up.
And then for the next half an hour, about 10 people commented, and they all had very similar sort of names. And I'm sure, maybe let's say it was 20 people were commenting, and I just blocked them immediately. And it lasted 25 minutes, and I'm pretty sure it was at most 20 people, but I think 10 of those people were the same people, because they had a similar way of writing creating their username. They used the same sort of glitch to make it happen. So either they were very close friends, or, you know, but you sort of think, that's it. It's you know, you think. And if you were sitting at home and you weren't aware, they'd go, oh, my God, I'm really being attacked. There's a big mob of people out there who don't agree with me about this thing, you know. And actually, it's 5 or 6 people who are tweeting a lot, or not always, I have to say. But I think when you realise that, you kind of go, well, this is nothing. And when you and you just take the power of it and let it go, you know. And I think with Twitter, I just, in the end, sometimes I would just get too obsessive about responding to people, and so more and it would sort of start to depress me after a while sometimes, and then I just started muting people after this thing where I said, you know, call people, isn't it just polite to call people by what they ask you to call them, right, which is just about anybody. So if a doctor said, my name's Dr. Herring, you wouldn't go, I'm not going to call you that.
Yeah.
You would say, okay, I respect you enough to do if that's what you want to be called. Hi, it's Rich. No, I prefer to be called Mr. Herring. I'm going to keep calling you Rich. No, I want you to call me Mr. You know, so you might think, oh, they're a dick for wanting to insist on that. But you would do it. You would call them by their name, right? So that was the absolute. And there was getting a lot of stuff, and it was really weird and really aggressive and trying to, you know, find moments of hypocrisy in my life, or find old routines and taking stuff out of context. And then I just decided to mute the people who were doing it, and the problem went away within about a day. It was insane. It felt like overwhelming. And then I muted, and not that many people, I would say 30 people. And then suddenly the whole thing went away. And then since then, it hardly ever happens. If it does, I just mute the next person who comes along, and then Brilliant. It's gone. And it's sort of, it was, you know, when I talked to someone else who'd had exactly the same group of people after, and he said, yeah, just mute them and it goes away, and there's no point in responding because they don't listen to you, and they just take everything you respond as being, as being a further evidence, or they find a way of twisting it and decide you're responding to a certain group of people and not to other groups of people. It's just a group of people who are obsessive about something, usually, and won't, are never going to change their minds. There's certainly nothing you can do in a tweet that's going to change their minds. So you might as well just ignore, and they're not going to change my mind. So you might as well just ignore each other. And what they want is the response. And so I think what that really helped me, and that's really helped me get through social media. But I think I'm unusual because I'm happy to, you know, I kind of almost quite like it if people don't like my stuff. You know, tweeting, I've searched my own name quite a lot on things like Twitter, and like people say that's vanity searching, and it really is not, because if you're vain, you would never search for that stuff, because you get to see what people are really saying,
yeah.
And as long as you don't weight it the other way. You're going to go, oh, no, everyone hates me. as long as you're not going, when you're just getting the tweets from people like you, oh, everyone loves me. You've got to get a balance. But, you know, again, as a comedian or a human being, if everybody liked you, you wouldn't be that great a comedian. You know what I mean? You wouldn't be that great a human being. You've got to rub people up the wrong way in order to do this job. But I think also if you're living your life in any kind of meaningful way, there's going to be people who don't agree with what you think. So if you have beliefs, you can't possibly get every, you know, I can't get a Trump supporter and Jeremy Corbyn supporter and say, you two guys are going to be best friends. You know, I'm going to have both of you loving me. You know, maybe if they go a bit further in the opposite direction, they'll meet up, but you're not going to get them together. So, you know, you just got to accept that not everyone likes you. And as a comedian, I think aside from Eric Morecambe, and I still see people saying they don't like Eric Morecambe, I can't really think of anyone who massively unites people, and often the people who have broader appeal really fuck people off, right? You know, so it's, you know, Mrs. Brown's Boys is a very popular show, but you'd never see more bile against Mrs. Brown's Boys or Peter Kay. You know, they're very popular performers, but people still hate them, and you can't let that get you. And also, you know, I think if you're an intelligent comedian or an intelligent person, you've thought about stuff more, and the stuff that I criticise myself with is worse than anything
come up with.
But I think that social media thing is very difficult. And if I'd been a teenager when that was coming out, I was very sensitive and very, very concerned about people, you know, so concerned about people liking you to the extent that I think you'd put people off liking you because you were too insecure. You know, certainly in terms of having a partner or, you know, a girlfriend, it wasn't good because I was too needy and I was too insecure. And who'd want to hang around with that? Nobody, as it turned out, for a long time. So, you know, I think having to deal with that through your teenage years is really, really, really worrying. But then all the things that kids have to deal with, you know, on the internet is worrying. But like, I suppose we're already through to the generations that have, you know, the first generation of kids who've been through that are probably in their 40s now, maybe, are they? I don't know. You know, so we will survive it and we'll get through it. But it's,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh, for sure. That's the thing, when you were doing the stuff with Stuart, and it, you know, you didn't have the internet then.
It was just starting up. But so we were in the mid 90s. We had a website and an email, but you know, it wasn't. There was no nastiness in that way. I think I remember the first sort of critical comedy forums, the kind of nasty ones, started up sort of just after we'd finished Lee and Herring, I'd say, and they were kind of, you know, you'd see quite nasty, snarky stuff from people who used to love you, you know, which again is the normal thing with comedy. And I was the same as a comedy fan, you know, you feel someone hasn't gone in the direction you wanted them to go in, or just you move on yourself to something else, and you think it's the fault of the person, you know, you blame the thing you liked for you liking them. So it's, and I've absolutely experienced that. You know, I guess like we're even somewhere like Rick Mayall, who I love, that was absolutely my comedy hero. I went through a big period of thinking, oh, but you know, his stuff's not the same as the young, it's not as good as the young ones. You know, and I regret it because he was trying different things out, and he was making his own choices, and he was a fucking genius. I did come back to thinking that, but you know, all those years of you know, I didn't turn against him. I would still have said I was a fan of his, but I would have been more critical of his stuff, for example. And then you kind of go, yeah, but, you know, look how good he was. He's not everything's for you, man. He's allowed to do other stuff. It's his decision.
And how did you find it when Lee and Herring came to an end? How did you find that? Because, because it was massive.
It was sort of wasn't. It wasn't. You know, there was a lot to cope. There was a lot to unpack and a lot to cope with. And looking back at it, it was a very stressful time. There was a sort of air of relief to it. We didn't really break through in a way that like a lot of the people we work with broke through. And, you know, we were a very cult thing. And what's lovely in hindsight and for me now is that the people who loved it have stayed pretty loyal to it, and also a lot of them have become comedians. I think it was a comedian's comedian kind of thing, and I think a lot of the youngsters watching it it inspired them and, you know, and spoke to them, and then they wanted to do comedy, which is good because it sort of means that the comedy I do still fits into the modern world a bit more, because the stuff as a group that all those people in the 90s were doing has certainly, you know, been an inspiration on the next generation or two. It was, you know, it was just, I think I found it, we work so hard, and I especially work so hard, and it's very difficult being in a relationship with anyone. Yeah. Like, so it was an unbalanced relationship. I did more of the writing.
Right, okay.
Stu was always pushing to do his own thing and was more successful on his own. And I wanted to do stuff of my own eventually, but I kind of saw that I thought the double act was probably, you know, I thought we were better together as a double act.
Mm.
But it was a stress, you know, you see what he's like as a human being, and he was very sure of himself. And I look back at it and I feel like it was, you know, because it was partly due to me, and I'm not saying that bullying is the fault of the person who's bullied, but I think my lack of self-belief, I sort of lost my self-belief a bit through all the stuff I did in the sort of late 80s and going to Edinburgh and being sort of pulled apart as being the student comedy stuff, because I was more successful. I was sort of the performer at university, and then we went to Edinburgh Fringes and we sort of got heckled by all the stand-up comedians. And so I had a very strange relationship with stand-up.
Yeah.
And Stuart didn't go through all that and did very well with stand-up. So that was an immediately sort of driving us apart, because he wanted to do stand-up and I wanted to do sketch comedy, and we sort of combined it in what we were doing, but it was always pulling in different directions. And again, I think that's what makes it successful. I think you need that grit in the oyster to make the pearl, and I think that our opposing personalities made that work. But when we started, I was the high status one, and he was a lower status one, and we sort of switched at some point. But I think it sort of transferred into real life a bit too much. So it was sort of a relief that it was over, because he was very critical and he was very sure. We sort of had the same sense of humour and the same sensibilities, and that's why it worked, and the same sort of idea of what is good and bad comedy. But it was, you know, he would never, because he'd done better as a stand-up, when we did double act stuff, we'd come off stage and he would always tell me what I'd done wrong, and never say what I'd done right. You know, it was even when you had a good gig, he would find, it's very like being married. This is what my wife is like now. whatever you've done, my wife manages to find the one thing that hasn't. When she comes down, when I've let her a line in the morning, she comes downstairs and I've played a blind and she'll spot that. Oh, what's all these things out of this cupboard?
I think he got to a point like that with Jade and I, where Jade would do these great things, but I was always moaning about the other shit, and she says, I did this. I'm like, yeah, but you didn't do that. But this happened.
And again, it's human, it's normal, and so, like, it's, you know, it's being a double act is like being in a marriage without having sex with each other very often, and which is a bit like being in a marriage, you know, and it's difficult. We were young, and I think it was, you know, Stu doesn't have any brothers or sisters, and I think I think that, you know, and I do have brothers and sisters, and they were older than me. And so I think I understood a bit more about that, about the sort of give and take of a relationship than he did. But, you know, we were very young and it was really hard, and we were in each other's pockets for 10 years. So when it ended, it was sort of good for us both to sort of be able to have a bit of time away, and then actually all the time away. We ended up employing him on Time Gentlemen Please, which was the next thing we did. So we were still sort of around each other, but it wasn't 24/7. We became a lot better friends, certainly in the short term, as a result of not having to be together all the time. And I think, you know, the things that made the double act work made it hard to be, you know, because I think you start playing it in real life a bit, I guess, and so it just I think it was a relief to that it was had finished, really. I would like to have done a bit more, but I also think it's kind of good we didn't. I think we might have been at the point, it was all just due to managerial changes really why it stopped. And I think if we'd done another series of the thing, the Sunday morning show that we were doing, I think it might have taken off. You know, Little Britain sort of took off just after that.
Yeah.
But I sort of think if we'd taken off like Little Britain, I think it would probably have destroyed us both at that stage. So I think I wouldn't have been able to cope for different ways than Stu wouldn't have been able to cope. And I think it was actually really good for both of us to have sort of time in the wilderness to think about what we're going to do. But it was very difficult for me because I'd sort of invested everything in the double act. My character in the double act wasn't really me. It was sort of a little bit like the sort of teenage me, but I was playing a character that worked in the double act. that I didn't think would work, not in the double act, whereas Stu's character in the double act was sort of what he was doing as a stand-up.
Right, yeah.
And so Stu was, you know, was away and running, and I had to work out what I was going to do. And I didn't really want to be a stand-up, and I didn't...
Oh, really?
I'd sort of had such a horrible time doing stand-up and been treated so badly, you know, in that fringe by stand-ups, and I understand why, but... You know, they were taking out grievances based on history on actual people who had nothing to do with it. And
that
was from, you know, I was in sort of the Oxford Review and stuff, and that we just got a point where, I mean, the Oxford Review was such a meaningless thing by the time I was doing it. Comparatively, I think you know, Rowan Atkinson had been the last person who'd come out of the Oxford Review. But all the stand-ups basically, you know, we became a focus of their indignation of the unfairness of the system that promoted Oxbridge comedians, which I have some sympathy with, but also, you know, it didn't seem fair to pick on some children
who
were part of it when you're grown up. So I had a very difficult relationship with all that. So it was very difficult for me to come back to stand up. And I suppose after Time, Gentlemen, Please, because I sort of came out of Lee and Herring and then just wrote for Al Murray for 2 years, but so intensively, okay? I wrote an American-style sitcom on my own, basically. So we did 22 episodes in the first series.
Wow.
And I wrote, you know, 90% of it and was writing an episode a week because we got given extra shows and literally on my own because Al was rehearsing the last one and I'd just go in, write the next one. It was very, very intense. Great, because I earned... I had like a lot of money, but terrible for my mental state. And when that ended, it was more, and then there was nothing else. And I wasn't sure what I was going to do next exactly. I was back doing one man shows and stuff. So it wasn't like there was nothing going on, but I had time to pause and I thought, well, why am I working so hard when, you know, I did Fist of Fun and This Morning with Richard Judy and no critical acclaim, right? I know that people liked it, but we were never up for awards. The first thing we did on the hour became this massive hit, you know, that spawned Alan Partridge and all this other stuff. So we had this amazing start to our careers, but then we fell out and over the rights and didn't end up doing the TV version of that. So you kind of, and you could see all of those people flying off into new directions. The League of Gentlemen guys were sort of getting big, and you know, you sort of go, okay, where is this gonna, you know, is it over? But also, why did I, you know, I gave up all my 20s and the start of my 30s just working, right? And I sort of didn't have much of a social life beyond going to Edinburgh and getting drunk and hoping to meet girls while drunk. You know, I had no money all that time. So until Time, Gentlemen, Please, I never had any money. And then at Time, Gentlemen, Please, suddenly I had some money, you know, I had a bit of security. And so you go, well, why was I working to this? Time, Gentlemen, Please, which I worked really hard. And again, no one really, I mean, again, people have stayed very loyal to it, the people who did see it, but... you know, it didn't get... I'm not sure it even got reviewed, really, but it certainly didn't get any uptake in those tents, and it was on Sky, so, you know, lots of people weren't seeing it. And you kind of... So I went through a real depression then, I think.
Yeah.
Where I, you know, I was just... And I'd bought a house to live in with my... I'd met someone, and it was after Talking Cock, so I was doing stand-up shows, but one-man show, so I didn't really see myself as a stand-up. And I bought a house to move into with my girlfriend and her son, and then we broke up, and I ended up living in this, you know, a weird... You know, this is where, you know, when you're looking at having no money and going, oh, I wish I had money, and then having money, and then living in a family house on my own. I mean, not a terrible problem in the sense of I own a house, or, you know, I'm paying a mortgage, but I own property, so that's nice. But it kind of accentuated the loneliness, right? I'd moved across town, so I didn't even have the network I'd had in South London. I was in Shepherd's Bush now, and I was in, you know, and I was thinking, is that it? Is that the end of my career? Is it over? And actually people were asking me to write scripts, and I had commissions to write scripts, and I was finding it really difficult to write. I was meant to be writing a book of Talking Cock, and I did write it in the end, but after passing about two or three deadlines, I found it really hard. And I just look back at my life actually now and think I was just drunk all the time, you know, not in the day, but like all the, I would go and get drunk every night or stay in and be miserable. I don't think I drank like on my own.
No.
But you know, I was lonely and really didn't know where I was going with stuff. And Yeah, and it felt like at that point, more than when Lee and Herring finished, at that point it felt like, oh, maybe, you know, maybe it's sort of over. Maybe I'm not going to be able to carry on with this career. And, you know, and it's such, and I think that's what's, you know, it's difficult. And we were never so up that it was like, oh, we were up and now we're down. It was, you know, we always felt like we were in the middle and the graph has gone a bit lower and a bit higher at times. I've never felt like I've had a massive success, but equally I've always worked. So even during this time, I was still getting enough work. And luckily, Time, Gentlemen, Please was one of those shows that did get repeated for a bit. So I felt like, actually, I'm going to be in financial trouble here trying to pay my mortgage. Suddenly, a lump of money would arrive from something already been paid for and saved me. And Talking Cock as well got sort of sold all over Europe, and occasionally one of those would do well, and you'd be being paid a few grand a month for a man in France doing your show, you know, and that was good. But also, but I also made me think, yeah, but you know, if we'd got a percentage of Alan Partridge, or if I'd ended up writing Alan Partridge, and that kind of money was coming in all the time, and it would have been for 20 or 30 years, you know, we could easily have ended up with 1% of Alan Partridge, and possibly should have ended up with 1% of Alan Partridge. But, you know, would you have ever done anything? Because I actually had money, and I thought, well, I'm not going to work as hard, because I'm financially secure, you know, no one gives a fuck. So I was depressed, and, you know, and I'd been broken up with someone as well, so I was depressed about that. You know, and I was drinking and whoring about a bit, you know, and when I could, and then, you know, being depressed when I couldn't. so it was, I think that was probably the hardest time to go through, but I don't think it was really, I think if anything, Lee and Herring stopping was probably more of a relief.
Yeah.
And then being able to work on my own or work with people who, you know, were more appreciative of the work I was putting in and what I was doing, you know. So it was, but I, you know, so I think all that stuff that happened before, I think all the, that's probably the stuff I would have to deal with is sort of going to Edinburgh and being heckled by looking into an audience and late in life and seeing all the people I respected sort of hating me for, you know, for no reason. Hadn't even listened to it. And that was a very difficult thing to overcome, which, you know, I then into, you know, and after a period, I sort of thought, I thought, right, I'm going to go back and I'm going to do stand up again. And that was the first decision that it was a massive thing to do for me, because I really hated it the first time. And I didn't think I could work on my own. You know, I thought I was going to be a team player with other people. I thought that was my thing. Even though I'd done 2 one-man shows, I still didn't think I was a stand-up. And that was the first big thing that kind of set me back on course. But even that was 2004. There was another 6 years before I think podcasting. I started podcasting and I started dating my wife in the same month in January 2008. So 13 years ago. Yeah. Both of those decisions and those things happening were the things that I think moved me on towards the possibility of sort of happiness and more stability. And for me, I think it was realizing that I could have all the. I just got so depressed in that period before in terms of writing stuff that I knew was okay or that would be okay, and having to go through all the processes of get through all the gatekeepers and all the people who didn't understand why my idea was good or didn't understand that a lot of the work I do comes a bit later on, right? So I'd given pilot scripts that were good, but I knew would be loads better once I'd gone through them with a cast, which is what I did with Time, Gentlemen, Please. You know, I could do that in a week. I could turn something around in a week from nothing to being a bad script that I then listened to be read out and then changed over the weekend. So I knew I could do it, but you know, even if you honed in, it was a good script, you were relying on someone reading it in the right way and understanding how the humor of it worked, which is not a given. So it was very depressing having all that work, and that's the thing I think in my career that I'm most upset about, is I think I was really prepared to work in my 30s like properly hard. Like, no, I don't think anyone has worked as hard as I did during Time, Gentlemen, Please, and I was prepared to do it. And you know, prepared to give up on everything else in my life, more or less, in order to do that. I sort of wish that in my 30s someone had gone, "Hey, look, here's a series. Go and do that." Here's the, because I, you know, had the energy and the belief in myself and the talent, I think, to make something good.
Yeah.
But then the sort of the getting the stability of, you know, falling in love with my wife and her thankfully falling in love with me and making that work has been great for me. Having kids has been amazing for me, and it's not for everyone, but it's and I'm glad I've had them late, really, in most ways. But I think, you know, I really, really appreciate who they are and what they are, even though they do not appreciate me. And going into the podcasting and just going, and even at the time when I started podcasting, and no one was, you know, hardly anyone was podcasting when I started podcasting, other comedians going, why would you do that? You're not getting paid. You're insane. You're nuts. Why are you doing that? And I was going, well, it's what's more important to me is I can have an idea in the moment and get it out there.
Yeah.
I could see early on it was going to be a way of, you know, just advertising yourself to people. I was, you know, and it was when I went back to being solo, there wasn't like a, and even when we were in the double act, we were touring, not that many people would come and see us, to be honest. You know, we occasionally played to audiences of like 500 or a bit more, but mainly we're playing to 100, 200, which given we were on TV was not that many.
Wow.
And so when I went back to stand up, I was right back to 20 or 30. And I've built up that my audience that I get now, which is still modest and is now, you know, occasionally over 500 as I'm back to where we were. And usually not let, you know, I think what the last stand-up tour I did, I was hoping to get over 100 at every venue and one got 94. But basically the average was about 250. Wherever I was, it was about 250 and sometimes 500, 600, sometimes 700, 800.
Yeah.
You know, which is great, unbelievably good. But I've built that up over doing a show every year and then starting doing podcasting and finding my audience. As a result, I've got an amazing audience who are great, you know, are a great comedy audience, and I don't get people who just go, oh, I've seen him on the telly, I'll see what he's like. Oh no, this isn't for me. So I get an audience who get me and who bring someone along the next year who will also get me. And any other comedian who shares my audience goes, your audience are so lovely, they're so amazing. So, you know, they're a great comedy audience. So I'm so lucky, and none of this stuff is planned. But I think just the autonomy of doing what I'm doing online and being able to do whatever I want to do, except obviously for things that cost hundreds of thousands of pounds,
yeah,
which I would quite like to do as well. is just so good for me. So the fact that I can play myself at snooker, if I'd taken that into a TV company, they would have said, you know, fuck off. What the fuck are you thinking? And they still would. I mean, it has actually been 4 minutes of it's been on TV now because there was a lockdown show where we used a bit of it. But, you know, I may go, no, I think there's something good in this. I'm going to keep on doing it. And I've been doing that for like about 10 years now as well. So on and off. And, you know, and the podcast, no one would have hired me to do an interview show, but I've done like 450 episodes, I think, if you include all the Edinburgh ones.
Yeah.
So that, you know, that's more than almost any interviewer in the world.
It's incredible. It's incredible.
Outside of America, you know, but even then, they're doing four or five a week. So yeah, there'll be American interviewers who do more than that. But yeah, there's, you know, you just being able to get on with it. And now it does, I mean, I realised it did make me money, in a way, anyway, because people would buy my DVDs or books or come and see the live. You know, I just noticed my live audience within a year or so had sort of doubled from 50 to 100. You know, it was that sort of difference. But that was that made touring viable rather than something that was a lot of work for, you know, a tiny amount of money at the end of it. It made a lot of work for a reasonable amount of money at the end of it, or, you know, a worthwhile amount of money at the end of it. Still not huge amounts, but fine. And you're building up a loyal kind of following. And I was, you know, if I'd planned this, I would be a genius, right? I'd be an utter genius, but there was no plan to it. People said, you're nuts for doing this. Why would you give stuff away for free? Why aren't you making people pay? But actually, you give stuff away for free and enough people want to contribute at some point down the line. It's still a tiny percentage, but it's enough. If you get enough people, then it's enough,
yeah,
to then start. You know, I wish it had happened 15 years earlier for me. Obviously that was impossible, because I think I'm still a little bit too old to really reap the long-term benefits of it. But, you know, maybe in the next 5 or 10 years I will be earning enough money from what we're doing to start making the sitcoms that the TV decided weren't for them, or to make films, or to do, or, you know, or to employ other people I think are good to make their stuff. because, you know, we're now starting to make, and I still see the podcast revenue as podcast revenue, and we just plough back into making more podcasts. But
yes,
it has got to a point where it's, if you've got 100,000 paid people plus downloading your show every week, you can make a nice bit of money from it, you know. So it was worth doing as a business decision, but that was the money wasn't ever on my mind, you know. It was, if anything, oh, maybe we'll get some work out of it eventually. But yeah, you know, even when we started, but really it was just, that'll be fun and that'll be a way of getting ideas out there, and it was a way of generating ideas that then became stand-up shows as well. So so it was you know, I think I was in my 30s. I think I probably was properly depressed most of the time, and you know, and those Edinburghs were so, you know, and they, I still get it in Edinburgh usually, like once most Edinburghs, where I will think I'm going to give up comedy. You know, this is crazy. Why am I doing it? But it used to be most of Edinburgh, I'd be thinking, why am I doing this to myself? Why am I putting myself through this? And you know, the pressure of Edinburgh was too much. Now, luckily, you know, people come and most of the shows are, you know, I know are okay. But it's, even when I did, you know, I did a play in 2014, I think it was, wasn't it, where I lost about 50 grand.
Wow.
And I, you know, and I knew from day three of the Fringe that was right. going to be the case. Well. And my stand-up show didn't do as well as usual because it was on later in a different venue. And I'd been banking on that. You know, I knew I was going to lose some money, but I'd been banking on that doing well enough to cover most of the losses. And I think I lost between the two shows. I think I lost, maybe it was 45. I can't even remember. It was a lot of money, right? That was a depressing year.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's been plenty of years. But also, probably in the three or four Edinburghs before that, I'd made that money, you know. So I'd got to the point where Edinburgh was not as profitable as it would have been if you'd been doing something else, but I'd probably eaten up three or four Edinburgh's worth of profit in that one year of disaster, you know. So it wasn't by doing two or three shows a year, I have to say, which is the way to make it profitable, and doing podcasts and stuff, which were, and working at the Stand and stuff with some of it, so it was possible to make a bit of money with some of it. So it was, so there's still depressing times, and there's still times when it's heartbreaking to have an idea that doesn't get taken up. And you know, there's been certainly loads, again, script writing wise, nearly everything I've written, you know, hasn't ended up getting made or has got a certain distance. And the last thing that I thought was really good, where we had Noel Fielding and we did a 10-minute taster and everyone loved it apart from the two people who made the decision. You know, everyone who worked on it went, this is the best script I've ever seen. You know, the director was going, this is amazing, and worked on proper stuff. And we had a brilliant cast and it didn't get made. And you know, that's still, you've to do this, you've got to put so much of yourself into something.
Yes.
And I think throughout my 30s, I decided not to put my heart and soul into it because it was too painful to fail. So rather than take the chance and fail and go, okay, you wouldn't make the script as good as it could be if you really put your soul into it. Because it felt like it, you know, it felt like, as a person who didn't have babies, that I'd had a baby and then I took it in and someone stamped on its head, and it was not as bad as that. I have babies, but it was, it felt that bad. So you would protect yourself by missing deadlines or you know, I think I have to blame myself a little bit for that time in my 30s where things didn't take off, because people were commissioning me for stuff and I wasn't writing the scripts in time, and then often I'd eventually squeeze something out and by the time I took it in, it was a different person behind the desk, and they're not going to take someone else's commission, generally speaking. So that's usually what happened. Sometimes I was unlucky and it happened, you know, not because I dragged my feet, but nearly every time I gave something in, it was to a different person than had championed me before. And I think, you know, and I think it was a bit of a, I think I slightly self-sabotaged. In order not to feel the disappointment of failure. As I've got older, you know, I don't think any of it matters. I think it used to matter to me so much. And the idea of being successful and the idea of being, you know, I wanted to be Rick Mayall. I wanted to be Rick Mayall. You know, I wanted the whole world to love me and think I was the best comedian ever. I wanted to be that. And as I've got older, I've realised that's not necessarily a great thing to be. You know, I didn't even learn the lesson of my own fandom of Rick Mail in that he couldn't live up to my own fandom of him, you know. So, you know, it's better to, you know, I feel so lucky that I'm still working. I feel so lucky that I've got, you know, I've met a fantastic woman who's given me two fantastic children and that we get on most of the time. And I feel, you know, I feel so lucky still to be working and to be able to be in a position where I do what I want and have the control over it and, you know, and yeah, and not have to worry about spending, whether I'm spending a quid in the supermarket or, you know, that not having to count every single penny anymore.
Yeah.
I sort of have lucked out and I think possibly, you know, and I can walk down the street and most people aren't going to know who the fuck I am. And the people who do will just go, hey, I like you. You know, so that's a really lovely life compared to what I think could have happened if, you know, Lee and Herring had taken off and become Little Britain.
Yeah.
I'm not sure either of us would still be here. You know, I think we'd have gone two different ways of self-destruction. So, you know, it's really interesting to look back on it. It's really, you know, it doesn't matter if, like, in my 30s, I might have had a sitcom that had been on TV that people might remember or might not. So, look, I had one, Time, Gentlemen, Please. Some people remember it and like it. Most people don't know it existed. It doesn't, in the end of the day, it doesn't matter. It was valuable to me because it was the thing that allowed me to own a house.
Yes.
But it's so, you know, and I knew at the time, I thought, well, as I bought the house anyway, I thought when the relationship fell apart, I thought, well, you know, the work I've done on that show is going to be the foundations of something for the family that I don't yet have. And I remember thinking that, and it was exactly right. You know, I'm in a position of some, you know, of not having to struggle as much as I would have had to do because of that insane work I did in my early 30s. I mean, I did 6 years work in 2 years, you know, and I sort of did 5 years work in 1 year, really, I would say.
Wow.
And, you know, but got 5 years work of well-paid, you know, well-paid work as well. So, so all the things that have happened to me, I think that's the thing to realise. There were times where I was probably, I don't think I would ever really have killed myself, but there were times when I felt like wanting to, you know, felt like dying. I think maybe in 2004 when I did the Hercules Terrace show, I took on lots of challenges and like running a marathon and doing parachute jumps. And I think a part of me thought, you know, if that running a marathon kills me, you know, that'd be all right. You know, there was, that's a good way of doing it, isn't it? No one's going to be like, oh no, why did he kill himself? Oh, he just was too fat to run a marathon. it's a bit sad, but you know, that's the way it goes. I think there were elements of self-destruction in that, and certainly not looking after myself well enough.
I do remember seeing you the first time I went to Edinburgh I was flyering for Just the Tonic.
Yeah.
And I remember being sat in a bar and I was just talking to a few people and I saw you were in another corner of the bar and you looked really crestfallen.
Right.
And I just went, oh my God, he looks really sad. Now I know that Edinburgh would do that to you anyway.
Yeah.
It's not life. It's just,
well, no, but it does. It feels so real at the time. And no, there are lots of Edinburghs. You know, I used to think about throwing myself off the bridge in Edinburgh, you know, with all my bad reviews stapled to me, you know, just so that all the reviewers, you know, and again, I was never going to do it, but you think, wouldn't that be just show the fuckers, you know, all the work I've put into this. But I remember the first Edinburgh, I saw Arthur Smith sitting in a bar looking morose. I said to him, you know, is this what I was saying to my friends, is this the business I'm getting into? He's one of my heroes already.
Yeah.
And, you know, am I going to do this and be that sad? And yeah, I was, you know, at times I was. But, you know, it's part of life and it's part of, you know, whatever you're doing, you're going to be sad that things aren't going to go your way. Mm. And it's the way you learn from those things and cope with those things. And I think it took me a long time to learn it. And I was, you know, I can't really drink alcohol in great, you know, on New Year's Eve I drank a bottle of champagne and a whiskey and a beer and I had the worst hangover I've ever had. That would have been the first hour of my drinking in my 20s or 30s. You know, you can't keep going, but I look back at my 20s and 30s and think I was just drunk every night. You know, I was drunk every night and, you know, didn't always have to get up. And, you know, if you got lucky, you'd wake up in bed with a stranger, if that's lucky, and you know, and then sort of have a hangover, but more or less be able to, you know, could get through. We did our TV shows probably with having been pissed the night before, and then got pissed immediately after we'd done it. And it feels like an immense waste of time and money and, you know, youth. But I guess it was, you know,
just
I guess
you're out of the time, yeah.
It's, you know, I guess it was good too. But it just feels, I wonder what if I hadn't had that, if I hadn't been drinking. And I wasn't, I don't think I was an alcoholic, and I don't think it was a problem even. I think it was just the culture that's what we all did.
Yeah.
But, you know, I am sort of, every now and again, I go through a point. I gave up drinking for 13 months a couple of years ago, and I've given up again, you know, post New Year, which is admittedly 6 days or something, 7 days. But you know, it's sort of, you start to think, oh, you know, maybe if I didn't bother with drinking, you know, all the stuff you could have done with your time. But yeah, I found it difficult to make friends. I found it difficult to go out with people. I found it difficult to, you know, even have romantic relationships without being drunk when I met the person. I'm not sure I had sex sober in my 20s. you know, and that's even with having girlfriends and stuff.
I must have done
a bit, but you know, and I found it all difficult to cope with. And I think a lot of the time in the 90s, you know, I was, you know, Stu wasn't interested in, you know, Stu was my main person I would see, but, you know, we didn't want to go and spend our weekends together as well, you know. So
no.
I would spend a lot of time sitting in my flat and on weekends and being too scared to call anyone, because you'd think, well, like, it's too late now, you know, I can't ring someone up on Saturday night, they'll be doing something, or they'll go, oh, you know, and I didn't want to impose on anyone.
Oh, wow.
And so I spent a lot of time on my own, you know, in the 90s, and then once I was, you know, in the 2000s, even, there was a lot of time. I think it took the Hercules Terrace show to make me realize. And I think I was probably having a breakdown at that point.
Right.
And actually getting through that show and doing the things I did, a lot of them were crazy. But actually doing it and completing it. And I did a thing in that where I dated 50 women in 50 nights.
Wow.
And just based on Hercules, something Hercules did. It wasn't one of his official tasks. but it actually gave me, like, the confidence. It made me realise, like, hey, there's loads of single people out here. If you actually just go out with people for the sake of, I've got to do this thing where I've got to date 50 people in 50 days, people would go out with you. But also, it was easy to find people. And I think until I was, you know, mid 30s by that point, and I don't think I'd realised, you know, just ask people if they want to go for a drink. It doesn't matter if you're,
yeah,
you know. And I'd been so wound up and so shy to think about stuff like that. So I think that show gave me the confidence to push on and do stand-up. It was what led me to do stand-up. It pushed me on to be, like, you know, to be more adventurous in asking people out without just bumping into them in drunk in the street. you know, it was a big thing. But I was a very late starter in terms of feeling confident enough about myself. And even now, I still have that sort of shyness and that sort of self doubt, but it's way less worse than it used to be. So
I have that.
But, you know,
this.
It's just, you go, why, I just, again, I look back on, you know, things that I now look at and go, that woman was so into you, and why did you not realise? And, you know, you sort of realise, but you were too shy to say, shall we go out for a drink? You know, in your teens and 20s, you go, why wouldn't you do that, you stupid prick? And so, you know, it does. And even if you ask them and they go, no, what have you lost compared to?
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
So that you know, and it is, and people found it, you know, people find it unbelievable that a comedian would be able to go up and talk to, you know, 500 people and then be too scared to talk to people in a bar afterwards.
I have it with this.
Yeah.
Getting guests for this. I get in my own way because I'm like, oh, they're going to say no.
Yeah.
So I don't email.
Yeah.
It takes me ages.
Yeah.
And I don't know why.
Well, me too as well. You know, and there's people you think, oh, you know, they won't say, but, you know, why not? Yeah, you're right. No, why not just, if you go and do things and you're proactive and you do stuff, mostly things will probably go your way anyway. But even if they don't, it's still better than not trying.
Exactly.
And, you know, there's levels of that because some people misunderstand. You know, you've got to be sensitive to understanding how social situations work and how relationships yes. work, both sexual and just friendly relationships. And some people, I guess mine a lot came from seeing people who had no social awareness crashing into a, you know, in Edinburgh or whatever, someone coming into a group of people and being annoying and not even knowing they're being annoying and being inappropriate and not realising they're being inappropriate.
Yes.
And me thinking, what if I'm that guy? What if when I go yeah. to groups of people, I'm that guy? So I would just, you know, I was so, I think again, because I wasn't on the stand-up circuit and because I had this relationship with the stand-up circuit, a lot of Edinburghs, I was just sitting around too scared to even go and talk to other comics and stuff. So I would just sit, I think I'd sit in the Pleasance hoping someone would come and talk to me, you know, but mostly they didn't. So a lot of it was, you know, just heading home on your own, feeling bad about your reviews. And it took me, I think coming back to stand up, 2004, coming back to stand up, 2008, meeting my wife and coming into podcasting and everything in between there, that gave me the confidence, I think, to just, you know, be sure enough of who I was. And but up until then, yeah, it had been a really, really difficult journey. And I don't know, because I don't know if I could go back now, if I could time travel back to me at 30 and go, look, mate, just, you know, you're okay. You're an okay guy to hang around with. You're good fun. People like you. You know, girls yeah. will like you if you bother talking to them. They will like you because you're not as much of a dick as most of the other guys. Even though you're a bit of a dick, you're still not as much of a dick as the other guys.
Oh my god!
And you know, would I listen or would I still? I don't think I would listen. I think you have to find those things yourself. I would say to people listening, if you're that person, do just try and be proactive and just. You know, I think what was really interesting about that 50 dates thing, and I guess it does, it's not so relevant now because people date in this kind of casual way much more in the UK now, thanks to apps of various kinds. Mm. So you can you have those hookup apps. But if you're looking for something that's more of a hookup anyway, or even if you're looking for a hookup, just, you know, doing something like this week I'm going to go out with 7 different people once we're allowed to go out again. Yeah. or I'm going to Zoom 7 different people and just have a chat with them. What I was amazed at was just how well I sort of got on with pretty much everyone, and even how people, there were people who were blind dates or people I might know through a friend of a friend, but most of them were like friend of friend. It wasn't like on the internet, random people. It was friends of friends, nearly all. And there were women you'd meet and go, oh, yeah, no, this isn't going to... there's not going to be anything going on here.
Yeah.
This isn't my type, or, you know, there's something I don't like about this or that. But because you spent an evening chatting with them, sometimes you would just go, yeah, definitely nothing there. But quite often, a couple of hours talking to someone, you would find that common ground. You would find that your type wasn't your type. You'd find someone else who's... And my type at that point was really bad for me, and I went out with lots of, again, kind of controlling... you know, mentally unstable people, which I was quite excited about. But then I realised, oh, maybe my type is someone who's a bit more together and is pleasant. Maybe that's... Could my type be people who are nice to me? Wow.
You're weirdo.
That could be my new type. So, you know, it's you learn about yourself and you don't, you know, you lose. And if you have a bad date or a bad social interaction or whatever it is, or a bad visit to a shop, whatever, you know, I wouldn't go to restaurants on my own because I was scared of, you know, especially in a foreign country, because I was scared of how you did it, you know. So I would just get a sandwich or just walk around trying to look for one cafe where I could work out how it worked, you know, or where I would be able to sit without people seeing me sitting on my own. As if, you know, if anyone's looking, who cares? They don't care, you know. They go, oh, is that guy in there? It's only yourself caring about it.
We're so similar.
But, you know, you just... So all these things, just give it a go. You don't lose anything by giving it a go, and you might gain something by giving it a go. And I think you'll find you'll mostly gain things. And if you've had a bad, night with someone, or you don't click with someone, as long as they don't punch you in the face or kill you, then nothing is lost, you know. And
I think
that's
one of those things. Yeah,
yeah. And there's too much. I think there's too much put on. I think it goes back to, you know, being a teenager and you're worried about what your mates will say if you about whichever girl you fancy, you know, and it's pathetic.
Yeah.
Because they all of them want to just have sex with whoever they can have sex with, or snog whoever they get snog. And then they go, oh, they'll only go, oh, what, her, out of jealousy that you've snogged someone. So, and you've still got that in the back of your mind. What will Steve Cheek say about this girl if he finds out I've kissed this girl? But it's about, you know, maturing and when you mature. And I was such a slow starter, and it's pathetic, really. But it was good for my career. And I was obsessed with being a comedian. I wanted to do comedy more than anything else. And I wanted to be funny more than anything else. And I think I blew a lot of potential dates and stuff because I thought it would be funny to do the wrong thing, you know.
Yeah.
In a dating situation. And also thought, well, and if this girl's into me, she'll find it funny too that I'm deliberately rude to her, or, you know, or whatever you do that undermines the notion of dating, or if I don't follow the conventions of dating and try and do something different. And, you know, occasionally that was true, but it's stupid. So most, you know, it's long in a lot of ways. Suddenly when you get to 53, you go, fuck, you are, you know, there's in it, you think you're going to be young forever, and then you go, oh fuck, I'm 53, fuck, I'm really old.
Yeah.
And there's no way, you can't go back, Rich. You can't go back to being 30 again. And I think when you're 30, you think, oh, I'll always be 30, I'll be fine.
I'm at that point now because I'm 50 next year. So I'm at that, I'm like 49. Yep. And in my head, I'm like, it's all over. It's all done. I'm finished. And I can't, I've just got to keep telling that voice to shut the fuck up.
Well, it's not all over, but like some things are over. And it's good that they're over. But you don't know. When you're 30, you just think it'll go on forever. And, you know, there'll always be, even though I got married, I, you know, if that went wrong, then I'd be back. You know, I'd just be back. Yeah. I'd be going out, doing it, drinking. No, you won't, mate. You're 53. Grow up.
It's tragic. It's tragic. Rich, this has been fantastic.
No, it's
Thank
been
you
lovely.
So Thanks, much, mate. Thank you.
I better go back and home.
Yeah, yeah. Where can we find you, Rich, online?
RichHerring.com will have most of the links. I'm on Twitter on Herring1967, where I tweet about all the Twitch stuff I'm doing. It's RK Herring on Twitch, where I do stuff, especially during lockdown. I seem to be doing 3 or 4 nights a week of nonsense on there, wow, including Rahalaspa, which is a bit less nonsensical. But yeah, just check your podcast for Rahalaspa, I guess, is the main one.
Fantastic. Rich, thank you so much.
Cheers, man.
Insane in the membrane.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Made by darkhorsedigital.co.uk. Shooting, live streaming, and podcast production.